Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to History Rage, our new podcast where we invite members of the historical community to get angry, to get a few things off their chest. My name is Paul Bavel and I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Kyle Glover.
Hello.
This week's guest is a lady with the finest job title I have ever heard of. This week we are talking to, and I am not making this up, the Conservator of Human Remains for the Surgeons Hall Museum in Edinburgh. Kat Irving, welcome to the show.
Hello, lovely to be here.
Lovely to have you here.
So, Kat, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do up at the Surgeons Hall?
Well, as my job title suggests, I'm the Conservator of Human Remains. So basically, at Surgeons Hall, we have a large collection of historical human remains. And this is everything from entire skeletons down to the teeniest, tiniest little ear ossicles. It involves a lot of soft tissue that's preserved in fluid. And so my job is to make sure that these are all maintained, because things do want to decompose. That's their natural state of events. So it's to make sure that that's not happening. So it's doing things like removing fat, it's changing fluids on things, giving things a bit of a dust, just making sure that everything is in tip-top condition, making new cases for things, and so making sure that they're looked after, and also making sure that they're given the level of respect that they deserve as human remains.
Sounds like a bit of a gruesome job.
I don't think it's so gruesome. I mean, it's lovely to actually be able to spend the time with these people. You know, I feel that is a huge privilege, and I love my job more than anybody loves their job. You know, it's a thing that I genuinely enjoy, and making sure that these things are looked after and respected, I think, is incredibly important. And so, you know, the fact that some of the things, you know, dealing with all that fat, sometimes things have mold that needs to be removed, you know, it's not the pleasantest, sometimes things are a bit smelly, it's still a wonderful job, and I think it's very, very important to be, that it's done.
Well, moving from the thing that you love the most to the thing that you hate the most, onto the rage. Kat, what is the one historical thing you just wish people would stop believing?
Well, one of the things about working in Surgeons Hall is that one of our star attractions is a book which is said to be bound in the skin of William Burke. Now, William Burke was a man who was hanged in January 1829, and he was hanged for the crime of murder. Him and his accomplice, who got off by turning King's evidence, they had murdered 16 people over the course of 1828 to sell their bodies to anatomists. Now, often the bottled anatomists were being supplied by body snatchers, people who are going into graveyards to dig bodies up. And so what you get is a lot of people will say that William Burke was a body snatcher, that Burke and Hare were body snatchers. And it simply isn't true. They're not body snatchers, they're murderers, they're serial killers. But I've heard this said in so many places. You know, back in the before times, pre-COVID, I would spend one Wednesday night a month at an event in the back room of a pub, and I always overlapped with the end of the whiskey tours that had been in there beforehand. So I'd be sitting there waiting for my people to turn up, reading my book, and I would often hear the whiskey tours telling the people there about Burke and Hare, and inevitably they would say they were body snatchers. But it's not just these tours. You know, I mean, back when I was doing talks in public, I would sometimes talk about Burke and Hare. And often if I was saying about Burke's hanging, I'd say, do you know what he was hanged for, to the audience? And a lot of the time they would say body snatching.
If only it was a hanging offence.
And it's not even, you know, just that, you know, even in sort of more professional situations, you know, the TV series Penny Dreadful, they had a scene where the character of Dorian Gray went to a waxworks museum and sees two shadowy figures digging up bodies, and he says that's Burke and Hare, the body snatchers. And I've even heard university professors make the same claim, saying the body snatchers Burke and Hare. And as I say, that's just not what they were. They were too lazy for that. Digging up graves, it's hard work.
Yeah, because you mentioned that. Myself and Kyle recently were at the Chalk Valley History Festival, and we did a demonstration on how to snatch a body, which, if the Surgeons Hall Museum would like it, it's available. And yeah, it was hard work. Throughout, we kept a Burke count by the cross-section of a grave we'd built for all the people that had come up and go, oh, is this all about Burke and Hare? 26 over the course of a weekend. And you can see why they kind of like cut out the work.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. You know, they're taking the easy route. You know, killing someone in the way that they did, you know, it's a lot easier than going into a grave at night, trying to avoid the people that might see them and be quite angry about the fact they're doing this, and then going through the actual, you know, the dog's work of digging up the grave and pulling the body out and then having to sneak it around the place.
We can confirm it's quite hard work. That's why we got our friend Rory to do all the actual digging when we did our display. We did all the talking instead.
It's not easy using a wooden shovel.
Yes. So how come this idea of them being Burke and Hare the body snatchers rather than Burke and Hare the serial killers sticks around? Why do people want them to be thought of as body snatchers?
I think there is something about the idea of body snatching which does cast a particular horror into people's souls, even now, sort of several hundred years after the prime of body snatching taking place happened. You know, I think that it's just something that gives it an extra layer of terror. You know, people are much more used to stories of murder and serial killers, whereas body snatching, it's got that extra frisson of something or other that just chills people's souls. So I think that certainly has something to do with it. And we can see that in the film from 1945 with Bela Lugosi and Boris Karloff, which was set in Edinburgh after the Burke and Hare events, the Westport murders. And it shows somebody who evolves, shall we say, from body snatching into murders. But they still call the film The Body Snatcher because that's what they think is going to draw people in and give it that air, that air of horror that, as filmmakers, they were obviously looking for.
Well, yeah, murderers are ten a penny, aren't they? You know, body snatchers are something a little bit rarer, a little bit creepier, a little bit more horrifying.
Yeah, certainly.
So kind of, I've got a couple of questions here for you, Kat, that we're probably going to get another guest on in a later series that I'm going to ask the same questions to. But you're very much from the kind of surgeon anatomy side. Do you consider the body snatcher to have been like the essential service, the heartless criminal, or that balance between the two? Where do you stand on, you know, the moral view of the body snatcher?
Well, it's certainly a bit of both, isn't it? Because from the point of view of the anatomist, dissection was utterly essential to what they were doing. You know, you often hear it portrayed as being just something that's being used for teaching medical students. But it was so much more than that. You know, bodies, the dissection was being done to do research, try and understand the body more in advanced medicine. It was also being done for surgical practice, which is a very, very essential thing. I mean, if you think particularly that this is the time before anaesthetic, the idea that the surgeon is performing a procedure on you for the first time, having never done it before, you know, I mean, it doesn't even bear thinking about. And so the example that I always like to give here is Astley Cooper. You know, Astley Cooper, who was like the superstar surgeon of the early 19th century. And yeah. He was a man who got to the position that he was in from doing the grunt work. He did a lot of dissection. You know, he had a very good relationship with body snatchers. You know, he would pay them a retainer in the summer months when he didn't do as much dissection. He'd often give money to their families if they ended up in prison. And he had them deliver bodies to his home so that he could do dissection before breakfast. And Astley Cooper ended up, you know, the equivalent of a millionaire of his day. And, you know, he was one of the most famous surgeons of the time. He operated on the king. But he was doing this from a position of really knowing his way around the body from having done all these dissections. His nephew Bransby, not so much. Bransby had, you know, had seen that his uncle had got this wealth and fame, and he kind of wanted a bit of that too. So he followed his uncle, you know, down that path, and he becomes a surgeon. But he'd been a bit lazy about doing all the dissection, and so the day came when he was going to be performing an operation which is called a lateral lithotomy on a man called Stephen Pollard. And Stephen Pollard was really, really happy that he was having the nephew of a famous surgeon carrying this procedure out on him.
Could you just, for a moment, for the people who are not anatomically trained, and myself, I'm a former anatomy student, but could you just, in layman's terms, say what that lateral lithotomy is?
Okay, so a lateral lithotomy is a way of removing a bladder stone.
Aha!
So a bladder stone was an incredibly painful condition to suffer from. People, you know, went mad with the pain. And the lateral lithotomy was a way of doing, of removing a bladder stone that had been developed the previous century, again, by somebody who was carrying out a lot of dissection. And it involved making an incision just behind the scrotum. So you make the incision behind the scrotum, you get the scalpel in to where a probe has been put up the urethra of the penis till it gets into the bladder so you know where to cut to. And then you widen that with your finger, and then you use a pair of forceps to pull the stone out.
And I now can't sit down.
You need to be fairly confident in what you're doing, because you don't want to be, you know, missing the stone and making the procedure taking longer than it should do. Because remember, there is no anaesthetic at this point.
Yeah. And I gather then that Astley Cooper's nephew is not the choice surgeon you might want if you're having this done at all, anaesthetic or not.
So Bransby Cooper, this procedure should take under 10 minutes. Bransby Cooper claims that the man has faulty anatomy. You know, it's too deep, but, you know, all this kind of thing. He even, because, you know, surgery was done in a theatre where there was an audience at this point, he even casts around the audience of, I think it was meant to be something like 200 people, trying to find out if somebody had a longer forefinger than him that might be able to reach in a bit further.
Ouch.
All the while, this man is there, you know, for this procedure, you have, you know, your knees drawn up to your chest with a rope tied behind your neck and your hands tied to your ankles. So this man is in this position while somebody's fiddling around trying to go, you know, grab this stone. The procedure takes over an hour.
Oof.
And Stephen Pollard, by the end of it, is just saying, stop, you know, just leave it there. And he ends up dying from an infection because the operation has gone on for so long. And he had an autopsy and was discovered to have perfectly normal anatomy. And you can actually see the stone that was removed, 3 centimetres wide, at the Gordon Museum in London. So this is the difference, you know. If you know your way around the body, these kind of things aren't going to happen. So having the access to bodies for dissection is very, very, very important. And Surgeons Hall is the museum of the Royal College of Surgeons of Edinburgh. We have donated bodies today that come to us for surgeons to practice on. So this is still going on. This is still an important thing, even though, you know, we have so many other methods that we can use today that weren't available back in the 19th century. You know, the actual hands-on practicing of these techniques is still used as part of surgical training. So getting the bodies is very, very important. But on the other hand, people didn't want to be dug up. They didn't want their loved ones to be dug up. At this point, there was a belief that if you weren't buried intact, then your soul couldn't rise come Judgment Day and you would be denied, an immortal soul. And of course, people being dug up, it's when people are in the depths of grief, you know, so it's a very cold, heartless thing to be doing to people, to be digging up their relatives, to be seen to be denying, you know, their chance of eternal salvation.
They're not just digging up relatives as well, though. I mean, my research has pointed me at they're digging up relatives literally straight after the funeral. People aren't in the ground, you know, more than 12 hours a lot of the time, are they?
Well, that's true. And of course, that was essential because, you know, one of the things about, you know, people when they die is if you leave them around too long, they get a wee bit stinky and the anatomists don't really want to be cutting them up. You know, when things start to be going a bit green and squidgy, it's not teaching you a lot about the body. So you have to get them out of the ground and to the anatomist as quickly as possible, really.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Talking about the acquisition of bodies then, of course, what kills off the body snatching trade is the 1832 Anatomy Act, which for the listeners that are not thoroughly into the Anatomy Act, basically what that allows is that the people who died in the workhouse who were not claimed could be given over to the surgeons for dissection. Now, this is the other part of the moral quandary here, Kat. It's like, where do you stand on the Anatomy Act?
Well, I mean, the Anatomy Act is a very, very complicated thing. You know, there were a whole lot of threads going into both the formation of the Anatomy Act and the results of it. But it certainly meant that a lot of the people who were being dissected were the poorest and most vulnerable members of society. And after the Anatomy Act, 57,000 bodies were dissected, you know, in 100 years in the London schools alone. And I think it was something less than 1% of those weren't from the poorest members of society. So it's definitely taking something, because prior to the Anatomy Act, the legitimate source of bodies was from the hangman's noose. It was seen as a punishment for murder. So you can see that the Anatomy Act makes it seem like it's a punishment for being poor.
Yeah.
So, yeah, again, we're still on that same knife edge of morality. The benefits to people from medicine, from the medicine that's being researched by these bodies, you know, it's a huge benefit to society. But you're also preying on people who, you know, were very vulnerable.
So sort of trading one form of immorality for another, you might say.
Yeah, yes, it is. And it really, that didn't change until we get into the 20th century and body donation becomes the much more common way of supplying these bodies. And that didn't really start to happen until between the First and the Second World War. In fact, in 1832, just a few months after the Anatomy Act passed, there was the case of Charlotte Bohme, who was a woman who had, she was described as having extraordinary opinions. And she had a child outside marriage. She died, as many women did at that time, very shortly after the birth. And she wanted her body to be sold to anatomists and the money raised to be given to charity. The problem was that the idea that somebody would donate their body was so alien to everyone at that time that they actually arrested her brother for murder, who'd taken the body along.
Interesting. Okay, so moving on from your actual day-to-day work rather than historical crime, we've kind of touched on this a little bit earlier in your introduction, but what goes into the actual logistics of keeping such a vast collection of human remains on display and in such good condition? I mean, I've been to the Surgeons' Hall recently. It is a very fine museum and very well laid out. So how do you do it?
Well, in terms of the actual of looking after the human remains, I kind of think of it as being like the sort of fourth bridge, you know, the idea that you get to one end of it and you've got to, you know, you've painted it all and you've got to go back to start again. So it's kind of like that with looking after the human remains. The drive for decomposition has to be constantly fought against. And even things that you think of like bones, they can get fatty, that needs to be dealt with. They need dusted, you know, things like that. And some things are constantly just needing the fluid changed. Again, tissue with a lot of muscle that tends to be fattier will tend to need the fluid changed much more regularly than something, you know, something less fatty. So, yeah, it's a sort of constant battle against that. And it's always sort of fascinating job because as you do these things, you really get involved with the stories of the people that you're working with. And again, that's one of the pleasures of what I do, is actually feeling like you get to know people. And, you know, sometimes you get to know them very well. Sometimes it's a more, you know, a more casual relationship. You might not know much about them, but it's always, there's always that amazing feeling of really touching someone from the past. I mean, obviously in more than just the sort of literal sense. So, you know, there's also the work of actually researching the people that we have. And yeah, it's endlessly fascinating. And of course, we were talking about the fact that a lot of these people would be poorer members of society. These are the stories that are often not heard from history. So I think that's something that gives it a, you know, an extra importance, that, you know, that we look after these things and we're remembering the people involved in them. And I do think that there's something that you get from seeing human remains that you don't get just from reading the stories on paper.
Yeah. Yes. That kind of ties into my next question on the ethics of displaying human remains. Some people get quite tetchy about it, but I think you've kind of answered the question already, that these are people and bits of people, and it's important to respect them as such.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that the question of displaying human remains is always going to be contentious, and I don't think we're ever all going to agree. Obviously, I couldn't do the job I do if I didn't believe that we could do it with respect and that it wasn't an important thing. So, yeah, I think it's definitely going to be a question where there's always going to be debate about. But, you know, I think that there's a way of respecting the people from the past and honoring their stories and being able to use human remains to talk about who these people were and understand them better. But there's also things that are very important for us today. I mean, some of the work that I've done, that I do, involves sort of sampling, and you can do genetic sampling with very, very tiny pieces of tissue nowadays. So things that we've looked at recently have included, you know, the development of the flu and the measles viruses. And obviously with the situation we're in with coronavirus, you can see why maybe understanding virus evolution is important. So there's that level of the importance of these kind of collections as well.
As I said, I've been there fairly recently, and you do have a policy of no photography in the galleries where there's human remains, which is quite contrary to a certain other tourist attraction that actively encourage you to take photos of Burke's skin and bone fragments. So I thought that was an interesting juxtaposition of the two ways of showing the same, basically the same human remains.
Yeah, I mean...
But you know the one.
And I've never seen that one, I have to say. I mean, I think there are certainly things that you shouldn't be able to do with sort of, you know, displays of human remains. And so, yeah, our policy of no photography is in line with how we feel, you know, that the remains that we have should be respected. Of course, we always seem to find pictures popping up on the internet that people have managed to sneak while they're in, which we would definitely discourage.
So you've given us an insight into a fascinating job that I'd never heard of before, until really kind of we connected on Twitter. How does one even go about becoming a conservator of human remains?
It's a bit of pestering and luck, basically. I did a degree in anatomy, and my first job out of my degree was cutting people up in the mortuary. So I was helping with autopsies. But I'd always wanted to work with museum collections. And so while I was at university, I had written to all the museums in Scotland which contain collections of human remains, of which there are quite a few. And I was just really lucky that the Hunterian Museum in Glasgow were actually looking for someone to work on their collections at that time. But there was no one out there with the skills. And so they were prepared to send me down to the Royal College of Surgeons in London to have Simon Moore, who's an expert in fluid conservation, coming to Glasgow to work with me there so that I could learn the skills required to do this job. And, you know, that's 20 years ago now. So,
thank you.
To finish up, what does the Surgeons Hall Museum have coming up in the future? What are you planning next? Any events or new exhibitions or changes to the museum?
Well, it's a very, very exciting time for us at Surgeons Hall, because I'm speaking to you at the end of August, and on the 11th of September, we're opening both our new gallery, Body Voyager, which is looking at the future of surgery, so surgical robotics. And we're also opening our new temporary exhibition, which is called A Model Education, which is all about anatomical models and the way they've been used for teaching. So these are both things that were delayed by COVID. So A Model Education was meant to open in April last year, and Body Voyager was meant to open last September. And obviously that didn't happen, for the way that so many things haven't happened over the last 18 months. Mm. So we've got that coming up in the next couple of weeks. And then, you know, we've got our event program over the autumn and winter, where I'm going to be doing a 2-week course on dissection and the history of dissection. So obviously that ties in quite a lot to things that we've been talking about today. So yeah, it's very, very, very exciting at Surgeons Hall just now.
Well, thank you very much, Kat. I mean, that was fascinating and really unique. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to learn more about Kat's work, one of the ways you can do so, first of all, is by buying a ticket to the online talk she's doing for the London Month of the Dead. So tickets are available for that at londonmonthofthedead.com, or you can follow her on Twitter at anatomicalcat. Well, Kat, thank you very much for joining us. I think you'll agree, Carl, that was absolutely mind-blowing and fascinating. Thank you very much.
Just wonderful. Thank you so very much for coming on the show.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you've enjoyed this episode. You can follow us on Twitter. I am at Paul Bavel.
And I'm at Kyle G History.
And you can leave comments, thoughts, and please send your own history rages using the hashtag #HistoryRage. If you've enjoyed our work, then please subscribe, leave us a review on iTunes, Google, Amazon, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks a lot for listening.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.